From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Utah's housing picture, which is complicated and frustrating for a lot of people outside looking in. And about a third of those who want to buy a house or condo are on the outside. First of all, there's not enough housing. And secondly, it's too expensive for most. So we'll talk about why. One reason, people want to move here or stay here. And so what do you do about supply and demand? We'll be right back.
KUER's Community Calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah's housing situation. And if you live along the Wasatch Front, you know what I'm talking about. High prices, low inventory is how an industry insider would describe it. Let's say you want a place in Sugar House or Holiday, or you're looking around trying to imagine the prospects for your kids living nearby. Well, good luck. The shift started in the wake of the recession. People started moving out and doubling up. It created a lot of surplus. And then 2014, 2015, the surplus was spent. The market started to tighten. And have you seen the prices people are paying these days? Today in the program, we're talking about what it's like to be a house hunter in this area, how we got to this point, how the housing shortage is changing the culture and people's expectations about owning a home. We'll also talk about whether there's any way to slow the momentum of this runaway train. Joining us on the program is Babs DeLay, a broker realtor with more than 30 years of experience in the Utah housing market, joining us here in the studio. Babs, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug.
Tony Semerat is with us. He is a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been covering real estate, growth, and business over the years. And Tony, welcome to you.
Hey, Doug.
And we have James Wood with us as well. He is the Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute here at the University of Utah. His research focuses on housing construction, real estate, and economic development. And James Wood, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Babs, I want to begin with you. You wrote a piece last month in the City Weekly where you explained basically what it's like to shop for homes along the Wasatch Front. And you made this analogy of it's kind of like going to the grocery store and not quite finding the products that you're looking for. Would you start there? What's it like out there is the question.
It's like going to the grocery store and you want apples and you're used to walking into your favorite store and there are 10 varieties of apples. And instead, there are 3 apples sitting there. One is green and you hate green apples. One is rotten and one is 10 times more than you wanted to pay for an apple. And that's your choice. So what do we do? There's very little inventory out there.
How do you describe, if you're a renter, if you're a prospective buyer, I guess it's there's low inventory, your options are just limited.
Very, very limited. And particularly with renters, I think, and low-income folks out there. St. George is the number one growing city in the United States per capita. And that means there's building going on down there, and there are zero rentals down there. So where do those people live? Same thing with Salt Lake. We're pushing everybody away from the true metropolitan areas and heading people out to the suburbs and the further suburbs and suburbs you've never thought of before.
Yeah. Where do people want to be?
Well, everybody wants the cool areas, of course. I want to live in the avenues if you're in Salt Lake or Sugar House or Murray Holiday or, how about Little Cottonwood area up in Provo. I want to live up in the hills. I mean, in Provo in the hills, certainly, and Ogden up in the hills. And instead, they're finding out that all the new construction is going in down south towards Payson. Whoever thought of Payson and Clearfield up north and in Salt Lake? What are these neighborhoods that we're now selling first-time homeowners called Poplar Grove and Guadalupe?
That's where you're sending them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there aren't any other options.
There aren't. I mean, my friends or clients would say, oh, I'd like to live in Sugar House, for example. And I say, well, what you're looking for, the inventory is $450,000. They can't afford that. So I said, put on a blindfold and let's run over to this really great place I know called Poplar Grove. You get the exact same age home and the cool charmingness that you'll get, and you will only pay $250 to $275. Or let's drive 12 minutes to this place called Magna. And it blows people's minds.
So wait, so you're saying people are having to kind of rethink
where they're going to live.
Where they're going to live. And also the kind of the cool places. They're mm-hmm. going to have to just, it's forcing them to sort of shift their mindset.
And that's for first-time buyers or visitors that are relocating here. For folks that are out there that are seniors or young seniors and they're wanting to downsize, they want to move into condominiums. Well, all those high-rises you're seeing along the Tri-City area are not condominiums. They are apartment buildings. We have a major crisis going on with senior housing.
Yeah. We'll get back to that in a moment. Tony Semerad, what are you seeing when you look out there?
Well, what I'm interested in particular is this kind of, what does that bargain hunting look like? And we get the quarterly home price statistics and measures on sales, and we're seeing evidence of people kind of looking out into Willow County more, looking further north. Those are represented in those sales numbers. And I think my own perspective is I kind of look at it from an outsider's view. You know, if you're locating to the state because your employer's just set up a new office in Utah, you've just graduated from college, you know, the scenario is actually kind of dire to find something that's affordable to you as a somebody that's just forming a household, you know, somebody that's just starting.
James Wood, do you describe this as a crisis? We often hear it described as a crisis. Do you see it that way?
It's nearing a crisis for – it depends on the income group. If you're over the median income in Utah is roughly $70,000, you'll probably price down. You don't get quite what you want, as Babs was saying. But there, if you're below the median, there's a good chance you could be priced out. And watching housing cycles over the last several decades, this one I think is distinguished by we've got a housing shortage, which we didn't have before, and the other cycles. And I think it's more difficult for renters as well. In past cycles, when we had a crunch and a crisis in terms of prices going up, there were still rental opportunities for most. Many of the young households now can't afford to rent. So that's a distinguishing, I think, feature of where we are now. And then we have a lot of doubling up because households can't afford, so they move in with family or friends. If you look at 2010, the percent of individuals in households that are doubled up and compare that to 2017, if we had the same rate that we did in 2010, there'd be 35,000 fewer people doubled up than there are in 2017. So that is we are on – well, again, there are winners and losers. If you're in, it's been a great run-up in equity for homeowners. But we have gone from – in the last 10 years from ranking among all major metropolitan areas, 175 metropolitan areas, the National Association of Realtors tracks. 10 years ago, our absolute price was 44th in the country. Hmm. We're now 23rd actually, in 2018. So we've leapfrogged a lot, and we're moving up. We're in the top tier, top 15% in absolute price of a home, and our incomes are not are relatively low. We are a low-wage state. We have pretty good household income, but we have a lot of people in a household. So
this gets us to this question, and Tony, I want to begin with you on this. When did we get discovered Because that seems like that this is part of it, right?
Yeah. Well, the easy peg date on that, of course, is the 2002 Winter Olympics. You know, we're showcase for the world. Look at our beautiful mountains, only 15, 20 minutes away. I think that really catapulted the state's profile. But I think that's a little misleading because I think we've essentially been discovered again in a kind of a meaningful way with our tech sector and the economy. The economy is a significant engine in drawing people to this area, which is a component of that population growth. I think it's important to note that this growth is being driven in part by people coming into the state, but it's also being driven by our very impressive birth rate.
How much is that? Because that's one thing you say is, yes, our economy is hot right now, but a lot of this is just internal growth,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I think those in-migration numbers kind of vary. Yeah. So it but I kind of think of it as almost a kind of a half and half thing, depending on where those in-migration numbers might be. But an important point there is that the birth rate, these are our own kids and grandkids that are driving a lot of this housing demand.
And the tech rate, your own radio station reported that 1 out of 7 jobs in the state are tech jobs now. And I'm experiencing a really unique housing dilemma in that a lot of people are commuting down to Utah County, mm-hmm. but they don't want to live down there. There's not enough to do. There aren't enough bars for the hipsters, not that all hipsters drink, but not enough things. So they want to live and hang out downtown here. Are they taking light rail? Well, no, it's kind of a hassle. So do they live down there? Do they sneak back up here? Mm-hmm. Then they want to live downtown. They can't afford to live downtown. When you talk about the low-income folks, let's say you have a high school student or grad student coming out and they want to get their first place. So they're going to be working like $15 an hour jobs. That's going to be $2,400 a month. If you divide that by 3, which is, you know, our general rule in housing, that's $800 a month that you can spend on an apartment, plus you're going to want your cable and your phone and all this other stuff. Where in the world can you find an $800 a month apartment right now? Nowhere along the Tri-City area and the major metropolitan areas. It's going to be double in downtown Salt Lake.
So part of the draw of this place has always been, as Tony, as you mentioned, so there's the technological part. And so that's part of the draw. The other part of the draw, I think you mentioned, is the recreational opportunities, right? You can go to the Red Rocks, you can go skiing.
No, you can't anymore. Pardon me for butting in here.
Yeah, good.
But we're doing such a good job with, hey, the Big Five are here. You can't get into the Big Five. We're going to start making reservations now to get into the Big Five. Have you gone skiing
yes,
this winter?
Yes, I have. Don't get me started.
Yeah, you've got to park a million miles away. Blah, 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 blah. We're doing a really great job selling this place.
That's right. Well, that does get to the larger point. Cost of living was also a draw for a long time. At what point does that start to turn back on itself? Housing prices and, I mean, we'll get to the question of what kind of effect this is going to have on the economy a little bit later. But talk a little bit about that, Tony, if you would, the kind of the draw to this place.
Well, I think an interesting dynamic was sort of sparked by Professor Coyne's study last May. Which sort of highlighted this affordability crisis. And what was really a kind of a turning point in that, it seems to me, was that the Salt Lake Chamber, which had been involved in kind of commissioning the study, kind of took that up as a cause. And so here you have an institution presumably dedicated to free market values. You know, capitalism is going to kind of take care of all of this, mm-hmm. showing a kind of a genuine policy concern that at some point this tight housing market is going to start affecting the broader economic well-being of the state, whether that's a major employer that's considering moving here but doesn't in the end because housing is going to be too expensive for its employees, or whatever other scenario it might be. This was sort of viewed as having the potential, at least on the horizon, of starting to
have a negative impact,
dampen
on the economy.
This economy. Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think we're not there yet.
Yeah.
In terms of,
we're still on the upswing. You think?
I think so. And yeah. One of the reasons your question a minute ago implies, so why is Utah a high growth state? And one reason, we used to survey companies that came, and the principal reason companies locate or expand is because of labor. And if you look at our wage rates, the average or the median annual wage in Utah ranks 31st among all states. That's still attractive to firms to locate here. Then you have
they don't have to pay as much as some other
exactly.
places. Yeah,
and we have a good labor force. Education attainment's quite high, and then we have geographically. We're located overnight to the coast, so it's very advantageous for manufacturers to locate here. They can get product to the coast, and we've got the hub, the Delta hub, so they can get execs in here easily. And then our demographics, that's just baked in the cake, and it's been there for a long time, and we have strong demographic growth and a lot of kids graduating every year, which is part of the labor market. So those are advantages that that firms still view Utah as, I think, a prime location.
When does that start to turn? It's hard to tell. I mean, right now, a company, if you're an employee, forget the employer for a moment. If you're an employee and you're thinking you've got a couple of options in terms of where you might want to end up, your wages aren't going to be as high in Utah, but you can go. Maybe you can go skiing. Maybe you can go hiking. The cost of living has been sort of considered reasonable. But at what point does that start to change? What point does that, as Tony mentioned, does that start to dampen your prospects?
Well, I've heard a few anecdotes out there where, I've got a close friend. His relatives, she was working at the Salt Lake Community College, PhD from Berkeley, and they were living with parents and just didn't see any possibilities of getting into the housing market. And she found a job at the University of Kansas and got a very nice 2,000 square foot home for $250,000. So, that is beginning to occur, I think. I think it'll be a while. Housing prices can't go up forever. Income.
Is that true?
Well,
I don't know about that.
Well, if you adjust for inflation, they are tied to income and then also economic conditions. And so you hate to, a weak patch in the economy, we'll see some slowdown in housing prices. But.
How is this changing us as a culture and as an economy? Tony, what are you seeing? I mean, you said the potential of the sort of these unequal balances. You're seeing things transforming just based on this one economic factor. There are others, but this seems to be driving a lot of this.
Well, it's interesting the number of times that a similar kind of anecdote emerges when talking about the housing market in a state very focused on family bonds and family values, given the influence of the LDS Church, families will often mention the new generation faced with this sort of Hobbesian choice. We're going to have to move away because we can't afford housing here. It's amazing how frequently people go to anecdotes like that in terms of how they personalize the effects of this housing market. This is spreading my family, all over the country. That's one way in which we're kind of evolving. We just don't expect our kids and grandkids to live down the street anymore. And I think at least in terms of downtown development, which, Babs knows a very great deal about, I think we're starting to see sort of visual, tangible examples of this kind of income disparity. So much of this apartment building boom, for example, is coming in at the market rate and coming in at the luxury rate. And we are definitely adding residential population to Salt Lake City as its boundaries are kind of define it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those new residents are coming in at those high income levels, and there's starting to be a discussion about, do we make Salt Lake City a place where people from all walks of life can live?
I wonder, James Wood, in your report from last year, you mentioned how the housing shortage has had an impact, of course, on all income groups. But those below the median income, you were sort of referring to this earlier, and the low income level, they're being disproportionately hurt. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to say a little bit more on that. Explain the housing burden for this group, because I think it's hard for some people to maybe understand that more than 50% of your income is going to housing. I mean, Babs was sort of referring to that. Yeah. I mean, that proportion is crazy high.
And that is at least 50%. That's a standard measure used by HUD. 50% is a what's called a severe housing cost burden. And if you're under the median income in Utah, you have about a 1 in 5 chance of facing a severe housing cost burden, whether you're a renter or an owner. If you're a renter, it's much higher. But overall, and that's not a small number, that's about 120,000 households that we're talking about out of a 1.1 million. So over 10%, about 1 in 8 households face a severe housing cost burden. And they are extremely vulnerable to a health event, an accident, a divorce, domestic violence. And those households live in – that's where the crisis is. They're in crisis daily, yearly. They will, most of them – many of them are renters, and they never get out of the rental market. They cannot for a number of reasons. And so there's a lot of pain out there.
Well, one of the, you point out, if you're spending that much on housing, what suffers is you have less on food and less on health care and on transportation and education and training, those kinds of things.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it puts a real squeeze. And that's why we see the increase in doubling up. And it's I don't see right now much relief in the next, say, 12 months, 24 months.
It's James Wood. He's a researcher at the University of Utah's Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. We also have with us Babs DeLay, a realtor with Urban Utah Homes and Estates, and Tony Semerat, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio, and our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been discussing Utah's housing situation, which is complicated and frustrating for a lot of people who are outside looking in. There's just not enough housing right now, and what is out there is too expensive for most. So we're talking about how we got here and how the situation is changing life along the Wasatch Front. We have with us Tony Semerat, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, Babs DeLay, a longtime realtor in the state, and James Wood, who's a researcher at the University of Utah's Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Tony, you've talked about how, and I know it depends on the city, but there is this, what's the conversation like right now about density and sprawl and like smart growth? Or how is Salt Lake or the Tri-City region, how is this region thinking about those terms right now, do you think?
Well, I think what I've been struck by is the wide spectrum of attitudes towards housing density. And just to back up a little bit, I mean, the fundamental principles of smart growth, you know, been around since the 70s, are kind of predicated on this idea that you locate housing near job centers, that you sort of plan in a holistic way for what an individual resident is going to need. And by reducing sprawl, you're reducing commute times. And that's some of what informs this argument for greater kind of housing density, build more houses using less land. In a way, you make it kind of more sustainable and more efficient. And I think just from my own reporting experience, you've got a kind of a wide array of attitudes at the city level towards density. Just looking at Salt Lake County, I think, you know, Salt Lake City has shown a proclivity to kind of want to incentivize these projects, especially around transportation corridors. That's, I think, informed a lot of the apartment construction we've seen in Salt Lake City over the last 3 or 4 years. You get out into the southwest part of the valley.
They hate the idea.
Further west side. Well, in fact, they cling mightily to these kind of more rural values. We came out here because we wanted a half-acre lot or an acre lot for our home. And this move towards density, this demand for density, is viewed as kind of a threat to their way of life.
Harriman's
a great example of that entire South Valley. But you see that in pockets throughout the state. We're seeing a couple of initiative challenges in Tooele, and I've covered stuff in Holiday, and there are disputes in Draper and Sandy, and most suburban communities have an example of this kind of dispute between the established residents and a view of wanting to kind of bring more density in.
Professor?
Yes. On a positive note, if you look at the data and not looking at prices, but looking at types of units that are being developed, we have the most high-density units we've ever had. This past year, we had 5,700 new condominium townhomes developed, and we had almost 5,200 new apartments. So that's about 45% of all new units developed were high density. Now,
is that a reality, just a reality of the market, or is there some sense that the attitude culture may be shifting?
Well, part of it is, I think, preferences for higher density by the buyer, and the market is responding. And some communities, I think Harriman's about done with condos and townhomes, but developers and builders will say that the cities are really lagging in trying to encourage that. But there has been quite a bit, and a lot of it is market-driven because of affordability.
Yeah.
On the condo and townhome. Now, with apartments, that's a different issue there. Part of it is many of the projects are financed through a HUD program, and the money's been available, insurance program, which has stimulated that. It's some of both.
Yeah, Babs, what are you seeing? Are you seeing? I'm not sure if it's a younger generation, or is there a more urban sensibility that you're seeing among people being willing to live in this more high density kind of atmosphere, or are you seeing any kind of a trend?
It really depends on the person. I don't know about trends, but I do know a third of my business is senior-driven, and I can tell you that seniors want to they like high density. They want to be able to walk for coffee and walk to their favorite little this, that, and the other thing. They want to be close to transportation, and the crisis that I'm seeing is in senior housing, 55 and older housing. There's just no such thing out there. I can count on one hand if your parents called me and said, hey, let's find a 55 and older project downtown Salt Lake. That would be like assisted living. Is that what you're talking about? Because it ain't going to be a condominium that's all 55 and older. I'm generalizing, but it's really, really a crisis. And you can't sell a senior a townhome. Townhomes are built with two-car garage, then your kitchen and living area above that, and then your bedrooms on the very top floor. That's not
appealing to them. Mm-mm. Yeah,
and a lot of people are now being forced with aging in place. Oh, we thought we would retire to a condominium. There are no condominiums, so I'm going to stay in my house. And I recommend, okay, if you're aging in place, let's start talking about your bathroom. Let's put in a roll-in shower now. Let's start getting rid of stairs. Let's make things accessible now so that when you're older, you're still here. It's okay to live here.
So it's just things are staying stagnant in some ways. No one's really moving. The inventory is just staying in place.
And no one out there seems to be addressing the senior issue. I'm generalizing because Daybreak has done a good job with that, but we need more of that out there all along the Wasatch Front. And St. George is, you know, senior housing down there, but there are many issues down there. There's no rentals down there. So,
how is, Tony, do you see, what about the younger generation? How is that changing the sort of sensibility of
that,
housing?
That to me is an interesting picture because I think the preferences of the millennial generation are kind of conflated with some of the binds that the millennial generation is in. It's sort of described as, oh, you know, they're drawn to urban living because they don't want to keep a backyard. They don't want to have to rely so much on the car. And many of those demographic factors are true. But I think we're seeing a generation come of age that's significantly more burdened by student debt, for example, have essentially grown up with the economic conditions of the recession kind of as an assumed. You know, they have more difficult access to credit. In short, there are a variety of economic reasons why millennials are choosing smaller and denser and doubling up and that sort of thing.
I'm going to add, I'm on an advisory committee for the Young Professionals of Salt Lake, which is a large millennial group here in town. And basically, I'm an old person that tells them they're doing it wrong. They're faced with young professionals being recruited here for the tech jobs, and they come in and they only stay 2 or 3 years, and boom, they're gone again. And so that doesn't really help us as a state, as downtown, as an economy overall. And they don't want all of these things because they're just going to be here for a minute. And the young professionals are having lots of conversations about how can we get you to stay here? When will you realize this is a really great place to stay?
What do you do about this? Will the government, and let's, Tony, talk a little bit about what the government, what the legislature or governments generally are or should be doing about all of this. If the private market is having a hard time changing the dynamics because, you know, this is just the reality, what can you do about that if you're a government official?
Well, in the debate as it's shaped up in our legislature, there's kind of an upfront acknowledgement that, hey, there's only so much government's going to be able to do. So this latest legislative session, the debate was kind of predicated on, that this is a free market problem and that the government's only partly going to be able to address. So they've essentially kind of taken two approaches. There was a proposal to substantially increase the amount of money that's spent into what's called the Olene Walker Housing Trust Fund. Mm-hmm. And this fund makes what's called kind of gap financing contributions to affordable housing projects. They've got most of their capital stack in place. They just need one little piece that's going to help them get over the line, as it were. And there's evidence that that's been fairly effective at helping affordable housing projects come online. There was a proposal to put a one-time chunk of money, about $20 million, into that fund and then put $4 million in every year after that in this latest legislative session. The financial part of that got stripped away. They got, you know, lawmakers got
surprise,
pinched by budget concerns, and so that was taken out of the bill.
Completely taken out.
Out. Another piece of that was a set of strategies that the state was kind of putting into law that cities could adopt to foster affordable housing. Everything from, you know, kind of making it a systematic part of their land use plan, that they encourage high density housing next to transit lines, that they explore, a number of kind of charitable ways of encouraging affordable housing. And by complying with adopting, if you will, anywhere from between 3 and 4 of these 23 strategies, the cities would be eligible for certain kinds of transportation funds. So there was a kind of a carrot and stick approach. That policy piece made it through. And so we're going to start to see, now in the urban area, most of the cities are doing at least a couple of these strategies. It's not a big lift for them to meet these requirements. But there will also be kind of a reporting piece that will come out of what was called Senate Bill 34, where cities will provide additional kind of information about what they're doing and the number of units that come online. But throughout the debate, even the most ardent proponents of this bill would start out by saying, this isn't going to solve the problem. This is not a silver bullet. This is not a sprint. This is a marathon. So there's kind of a recognition that, A, cities don't build housing, state doesn't build housing, it's the private sector. But what can we do? Yeah. You know?
How do you see it, Professor? I mean, what is it that, I mean, historically, if you look in historical terms, what have governments been able to do to influence any of these trends?
Well, the distribution of housing that we have now, the types that we have, the locations, the prices are a function of government. Zoning ordinances determine that long term. And we can't really – we don't have much leverage on housing.
So we're the way that we were – we're the way we are because of the way we developed a long time ago.
Local policy has determined the distribution of housing, the types of housing, which affects prices. Government plays a big role. Now, but as Tony said, we're a bit adverse, and I was quite disappointed – with the legislative session. There was a lot of momentum last session a year ago, and a lot of it swirled around the homeless, and hoping that we'd get some more something a little bit more robust than what we ended up with. But it comes down really, if you look at housing prices, what's driving prices? Land costs, again, that goes to zoning. Then you've got material costs, labor costs. We don't have much control over that. The point of entry or leverage is the local community, and that is I've followed it for a long time, and that is really difficult to make inroads. Salt Lake City is, you know, it's a poster child, what they have done for over the years for affordable housing. And there are a few others that have done well. But most cities, the city council, they will, what we had in Cottonwood Mall, where you have the planning commission unanimously approve, city council unanimously approve, and it gets shot down. Zoning by referendum, and it flies in the face of the children. It's really about the next generation. I hope next session it'll be more meaningful financially than it was this session. But unless you take really aggressive measures, and I think it's Minneapolis, just did away with single-family zoning.
That's not going to happen here,
no,
I don't think.
No, it will not happen
here.
But having been a planning and zoning commissioner for 8 years for Salt Lake City and volunteer chair of the Planning Commission, I can tell you no one shows up to planning and zoning meetings. So the public input is very, very low, even on the internet with, you know, just chime in right here and we'll read that. No, nobody did that. But towards the end of my term, we were starting to talk about ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and this is what everybody is pushing for now, especially because of Airbnb, which is a whole factor affecting our housing here, affecting our housing in Park City, in St. George, and what have you. But everyone wants a rental unit or a unit where their kids could live during college, and people fight it like there's no tomorrow on one side, and the other side is like, what's that going to do to you? I want my kid to live here in my garage. What's wrong with that? And that is such something that every community has to be dealing with right now.
One of the things that you've done in the report, Professor, is project forward, assuming the conditions sort of stay like this. Mm-hmm. And you say in the next 26 years, the median price of a home along the Wasatch Front is going to be somewhere in the area of $1.3 million.
Sorry.
Can I interject?
$1.3 million. And when you plug in the rate of inflation, it's more than $730,000. That's median.
Door.
Yeah,
wow.
That's a simple extrapolation, that first number, and that's not going to happen. But
wow.
And the second number, in today's terms, $730,000, I don't think will happen. I think it's much more likely that we'd have
You mean something's going to mediate that?
Interest rates probably long term, likely to go up.
Heading up.
And also economic growth is expected to slow. If you look at our demographic and employment projections. It looks like things will slow down in the long term. So I think if you take a reasonable number, which would be half the rate, half the real rate, that would put us at about 500,000 in today's market. A generation from now, and I think that's very realistic. That's somewhere between, it's less than Seattle and Denver, but what will be, as I said earlier, we're in the top 24. I would guess in another generation we'll be in the well within the top 20 in terms of housing prices, and we will have prices commensurate with what Denver is now in Seattle.
And when I started in the business 35 years ago, homes were selling in Sugar House for $49,000, which are now selling for $499,000.
Yep.
That's 35 years. So I can't believe the the millions. I'm joking on that.
Well, but that gets us to the question we were sort of talking about before. At what point does housing become an issue that could affect the economy? It doesn't seem to have slowed things, for example, in the Bay Area. I mean, growth and economic prosperity keeps
going.
It's
going to.
But do you think?
Well, the New York Times just came out with all of the IPOs that are happening now with Pinterest and Lyft and what have you. And the owners of these new billionaires are moving to places like San Francisco, and they predict that San Francisco prices are going to double because of these people. And that is incredible. Incredible housing situation over there. So,
but are we headed somewhere like that? I mean, maybe not on that scale, but are we headed somewhere that's just not sustainable?
I vote yes.
Well, so backing on to this issue in a fairly significant way to me is the whole idea of transportation and how you move people around this valley. And if you continue to use a kind of a sprawl-based land use model, where, you know, you're going with larger acreage lots and that sort of thing, you're essentially building an escalation of vehicle miles driven in this valley. You're essentially locking in a very poor air quality picture.
Yeah. Which is already bad.
Which is already bad. And it's fairly easy to see that becoming an economic damper, as it were.
I think it already is in some ways, don't you think?
If you talk to companies that are trying to recruit talent to this valley, it most certainly is.
Yeah.
What it seems to me is if you're kind of building that into it's baked into the land use model around here. There's something sort of inexorable about, you know, that you could throw all the money and all the policy moves at air quality you want, but if you've sort of got that base that's contributing to the airshed, is economically untenable to me.
And if our legislature took up the idea of having public transportation that's free, having served on the UTA board and always telling people we should have public transportation is free, that could really help us with our air and planning, because when you build public transportation, you build along those lines as you see all the apartment buildings going up along tracks and light rail and what have you. Build it, they will come.
Right. And that goes back to Professor Wood's point that, you know, cities can build in their zoning ordinances ways that encourage that kind of development.
Yeah.
So in some ways it could force developers, public officials to be more progressive in the way they think about planning their communities.
Yes. And in meetings, you hear lots of, comments that seem to support that. But then when you get to a large high-density project, which would address the issue of affordability, on the Olympia Hills, I was on a panel with a developer, and he confessed that he was very naive. He did not understand the power of social media. They thought they had it approved, and within a week, it was deep sixed by Facebook and the citizens. So, you know, it's a long battle. I mean, this is. And I think we're in a better place than we were, say, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. Legislators at least are interested in talking about it and understand the issue. But the next step is to get some movement and the state legislature could provide cover for local communities. And that might, but that's a tough sell as well. But if they had some sort of really stiff, and we don't want to use the word mandate, but if encouragement that would give the cities cover where they could say, this is what the state says, then we'd get some real movement.
So what's going to affect this? It seems like the only way out is if the economy slows down. Good sense of thinking that that might happen, I suppose. Population growth, Tony, that's not going to slow down. That's not going to. I mean, so what's the way out of this? Is the economy going to slow down? I mean, Babs, one of the things you mentioned, it's a fairly well-managed state. That doesn't seem to be.
And that's one of the reasons I choose to live here, is that our legislature is very good with the purse strings. It's a healthy state economically. And just in the immediate future, let's think, we've got this giant airport that's going to open. We have a prison next door that's going to be opening. And then we have this port that's going to be opening. And we're going to have a transportation hub that's going to move out to about 5600 West. And Tooele is going to seem like driving from downtown to Sugar House. I don't see an end to this because we're offering a state that's beautiful, things to do. We have incredible tech here. We have incredible businesses here and startups and startups and startups. And that was just like Silicon Valley. You start out with a couple of companies and then you have all these branch companies that support it. And think of all the companies that are going to be supporting that airport, that hub, and that prison out there. Our future here in the next 10 years is amazing growth, and we're trying to get the Olympics back. Hello.
Do you agree? Do you think that's right?
Well, I do. I think that's right. I think against that backdrop, though, I've been struck in the last 4 or 5 years how much the conversation's changed. I think the average resident has a sort of a basic set of tropes that they understand the issues of density. They understand how their way of life may be changing with some of this growth. I don't think there's any sort of direct threat, but there's started to be sort of a dialogue on the state's own economic development recruitment efforts. Mm-hmm. You know, should there be sort of an additional component where these big employers are responsible for housing too? So I feel the conversation is sort of shifting. Whether that leads to a productive outcome down the road, I don't know, but I do get a sense that those themes are basically out there.
So, what is Salt Lake City? What are this? Let's broaden it along the Wasatch Front. What are we going to look like in 5 years? Is there a model that you see that we're going to be a bit like? Are we like a Portland, an Austin, a Denver? Those names I see coming up from time to time. What do you think?
I think really in the last since the recession, and we've been discovered a few times, but I think since then we reached a critical mass, and we've had a lot of national publicity. We've got national firms here, Adobe, Amazon, Facebook's doing a facility. And that period from 2010 to the present, Utah leads the country in the rate of growth in jobs and demographics. And I think that will continue. We'll have additional pressure on the infrastructure, additional pressure on housing prices. I don't see any relief in the next 2 or 3 years. I think it's more of the same. As you mentioned, when you get a slowdown in the economy, the housing prices will probably decelerate a bit. I don't think we're going to. Where I work, there are several millennials, and they're waiting for housing prices to go down. And I keep telling them it's not going to happen.
Not this month.
Okay, so Babs, you are somebody comes to you. They are lifelong Utahn, and their kids are just about ready to graduate from college, and they're going to get a job here. What do you say to them? They're like, I want my kids to get into. I want them in. You know, I want them. What do you say to them? What's the advice that you offer to them?
I ask them, can you help them purchase a home? Are they going to have roommates? Do you want an investment like a duplex that they can live in one side and use the other side as rental? Do you want to talk about your family's assets and put this into a package where you think about this a little stronger than, hey, let's hope the kid gets a house someday? No,
so they have to be more creative.
Absolutely. And talk about a bigger picture amongst the family investing. I'm having that broader conversation more and more often with people, and then flip it around. And hey, kid, now that you're going to get a house, you're going to have to take care of your parents. So what's that going to look like in housing? Is it going to be the place that you buy? And is it going to have to build an accessory dwelling unit there? Or are we going to buy a duplex where they can live on one side and we'll live on this side? It's a long range plan these days more than, hey, let's just go buy a home.
Tony, final word. It's going to get complicated, I guess.
To me, there are certain questions about proof of concept with regard to what well-executed high-density housing projects look like. If we're wall-to-wall city, but it looks like daybreak around here, I think that's a little bit different than sort of classic 1970s sprawl. So I think it is a complex picture to kind of know what this valley's going to look like. But growth is kind of inevitable in a certain way.
Yes, and they're not building any more land. So we can't sprawl downtown Ogden or downtown Provo. It has to sprawl generally out west.
Is it up on the West Bench then? And
yes.
What does that look like?
Uh-huh. Lots of questions.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all very much for joining us. Tony Semerod, a reporter of the Salt Lake Tribune covering real estate growth and business. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Babs DeLay, good to see you.
Good to see you always.
Realtor with Urban Utah Homes and Estates joined us here in the studio. And James Wood, a researcher at the University of Utah's Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Thank you very much for taking the time. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.